I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate passed a two-year budget by a vote of 64 to 36. This was after the House overwhelmingly passed the deal in a vote last week. It now goes to President Obama for his signature. It's been several years since Congress agreed on a budget. We asked Ed O'Keefe to break down the numbers and to tell us whether this bipartisanship is an aberration or a sign of a more cooperative mood in the U.S. government. He's congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. And Ed O'Keefe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
So is this an aberration or a sign of cooperation in our U.S. government?
Well, I think it's both, frankly. I think really this is mostly the result of the fact that the lawmakers had seen the polling in the last few months, especially since the government shut down, and understood that they weren't going to be able to go home and enjoy their holiday season unless they could demonstrate that they had actually done something this year. Almost to a person, we have seen lawmakers of both parties in both chambers issue statements that say something along the lines of, this isn't the deal I would have negotiated, but, you know, they're going to vote for it, or in many cases they voted against it because, and it was mostly among fiscal conservatives who said that this violated the tenets of previous spending agreements. But for those that voted for it, you know, they see this as an ultimate example of compromise. It doesn't have everything they want. It has several things they don't like. But they knew it was necessary in order to demonstrate progress and to avoid yet another government shutdown beginning in mid-January.
And how many years has it been since the U.S. Congress passed an actual budget?
It's roughly 2009 that the process has been since they haven't done or used regular order, what we call regular order, where Congress passes a budget, there's an appropriations process, and things are sorted out that way. So that just demonstrates that really since for the duration of the Obama presidency, we've been in this situation where things have not gone as they were supposed to.
Help us understand what this budget does. I guess what it does to the sequester.
Well, what it does is it basically restores some of those automatic budget cuts known as sequestration or the sequester, primarily around things like the Pentagon. There had been big concerns that the Defense Department was going to take a bigger than anticipated hit and that it was really going to begin having problems when it came to force readiness. And really its ability just to function and to continue operations in places like Afghanistan or various operations ongoing in Asia. Military leaders had really expressed concerns. And this wasn't just sort of government or agency leaders worried that their money was going away, but there were genuine concerns among both parties that perhaps the Pentagon was going to take a bigger than anticipated hit. Other parts of the government spending does get restored, but not nearly as dramatically as it does at the Pentagon. On the other side of that, though, I guarantee you we have people listening today who know veterans that are likely going to see a bit of a hit on the other side of this in order to shore up some of those cuts. And you know, several military retirees, you know, mostly folks between early 40s and early 60s, are going to see some changes to their retirement packages in order to restore some of those cuts.
And we're talking about cutting the cost of living adjustments by 1% for those under the age of 62 who have retired from the military. And I know if, John McCain and some others were kind of pushing back. Even the Pentagon has admitted that the cost of some of these pensions and just payments are eating into its overall budget.
Right. I mean, you've seen personnel costs at the military really more than double since 9/11, even at a time when the actual size of the force has shrunk overall. That's because you have so many people retiring now, and, you know, just like any other organization, they're starting to see higher personnel costs. And the reason that negotiators did this and the reason that people like John McCain supported it is that these are people who are coming out of the military after several decades of service and likely going right into another job, either as an academic or some government contractor or perhaps as an HR specialist in some private company. And so they will you know, continue receiving a paycheck and will have a second career and could conceivably afford to pay a little more towards their retirement benefits that their new employer isn't going to have to pay because that employee is enjoying health care and retirement benefits from the military. So the theory was, This group of people, who until about the age of 62 would see slight reductions, can afford this because most of them are going to go into a second career. And then once they hit 62, those cost of living adjustments return, and just like any other older person who's retired, they would continue to see cost of living increases rise as originally scheduled.
Do you think those COLA cut will be reinstituted or instituted back into the budget?
Well, that's a smart question because you have seen in the last few days Democratic and Republican senators mm-hmm. suggest that there's got to be a better way. And so they're going to make a push next year to find a way to restore those cuts and find savings elsewhere. Democrats are going to go after a series of corporate tax loopholes, which is something they've always wanted to go after. They're not likely to find a lot of Republican support for that. Republicans on the other side are saying, let's restore those and find other ways to cut funding in other government agencies, which, of course, upsets Democrats. So we'll see whether or not they actually can find a way to fix this. But again, the other argument is, and you've seen Senator McCain and others make this, is you've asked civilian federal employees, people who work at the IRS, the Social Security Administration, the TSA workers, the top-level lawyers at the Justice Department, or top-level economists at the FDIC, endure pay freezes, cuts to their benefits, and really a very difficult process of rising through the ranks in recent years as part of these rollbacks, that if you're going to ask the civilian side of the government workforce to do this, it's time to start mm-hmm. asking military folks to do it as well.
What happens to unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed in this country?
Well, they have been cut as part, or they're not being renewed as part of this agreement. And here again, you're going to see a coalition of lawmakers, mostly Democrats, try to push to restore them next year. Whether or not that happens, though, remains to be seen. I know Democrats in the House are pushing for it, but it's kind of a non-starter with Republican leaders. Harry Reid is expected to hold a vote on some kind of proposal once the Senate gets back in early January, but there again it might be blocked. Part of the argument here, at least among Republicans, is, look, the economy is beginning to improve. Many of these people are going to be able to find work as things improve, and you know there are other benefits available to them, and it just generally flies in the face of Republican attempts to roll back various public assistance programs for people, whether it's food stamps, unemployment insurance, or other types of programs.
And where does the deficit, the debt slash debt, where does the deficit stand today? Do you know?
I don't know the figure off the top of my head, but it remains still quite large. And many lawmakers, part of the reason they're holding their nose, as they I just found it, $17.2 trillion.
Thank you very much. Okay.
And that show debt remains at that. I had it in my notes. I just couldn't find it.
Thank you for finding it.
That is part of the reason why lawmakers were holding their nose, really, throughout this agreement, is they understood that this agreement doesn't necessarily do anything to address that issue. And so, there once again will be attempts next year and into the coming years to find other ways to do this. At this point, really, the only thing left to do is to start dealing with the structure of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid for years, for decades, really. Congress has avoided any serious conversation about that. Unlikely you're going to see a very substantive conversation about it in an election year, especially when you have several Republican senators at risk of significant primary challenges and several Democrats in states that are facing difficult reelections as well. So that remains a big problem. This didn't necessarily do it, but what it did do and why there is great hope for this agreement is it removed the threat of another government shutdown for at least 2 years.
Hmm.
That will give government agencies a lot of certainty. That will give the business community some certainty of what to expect. And that, they hope, will help propel economic growth, help bring down that unemployment rate to the point where once these conversations have to start again in earnest in 2 years, perhaps the economic situation is a little different and things can be adjusted accordingly.
This is a question about last week, but how significant was Speaker John Boehner's pretty public criticism of some of these conservative outside groups that were pushing back against that vote in the House?
Well, it was significant because he finally said in public what we've known him to believe in private for several years. And that is not necessarily that these organizations shouldn't exist. He believes that they're helpful to sort of whipping up concern and whipping up support for conservative and Republican proposals and candidates. But what he is bothered by is that they're so intransigent and so unwilling to admit that they're not necessarily getting everything they want. This is a guy who, you know, has been in Congress since the early 1990s. He is a big fan of doing big things through legislation, and of course that has been nearly impossible in recent years. Mm. He's also a big fan of the House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, former vice presidential candidate who many people see as a potential future speaker or future presidential candidate. So when you see one of his favorite legislators, Paul Ryan, cutting a significant bipartisan agreement with a Senate Democrat and all but ensuring that the government won't shut down for 2 years, and then these groups go out and begin trashing the agreement before it's even been formally released, you know, that, as Paul Ryan said, got the Speaker's Irish up a little bit, and that's why you saw him so clearly, so explicitly go after them. It was, in a sense, a culmination of years of frustration for Boehner, because not only have these groups like Club for Growth, Heritage Action, and other conservative groups that are beginning to prop up that have been causing trouble for him, but they are in turn influencing dozens of fiscally conservative Republican House members and making it difficult for the conference to move forward with things like the budget agreement or immigration reform or other big pieces of legislation.
Well, and he seemed to be saying is that they are fighting against this for their own reasons, to raise money, you know, to grow their organizations, not to necessarily help their conservative counterparts, I guess, if I can say that, in Congress.
Right, but in turn, by having the Speaker go after them, you want to guess how much money they've probably raised in the last week?
Sure, it's a considerable sum. So everyone goes home for their Christmas break. They'll come back in January. Ed, what happens next?
Well, that's a big question. You know, certainly now that this issue, the immediate concern about government spending, is out of the way, it turns now to the House and Senate Appropriations Committee to work out the details. Some kind of an appropriations agreement will have to be passed by January 15th, and that is expected to happen. We understand that appropriators now are working with the guidelines of this budget agreement, and we'll set the details, dot the I's, cross the T's, and Congress will pass that. Hmm. The other thing they've got to do, they've got to finish work on a long-term farm bill, which is more than 2 years overdue already. That, of course, deals not only with agriculture policy and programs to shore up the nation's cotton farmers, rice farmers, soybean farmers, but also sets funding for the federal food stamp program. That has been a target of cuts. You'll recall over the summer that House Republicans agreed to cut the program by about $40 billion over the next decade. Democrats were looking for about $4 billion in cuts. Right. We're expecting cuts closer to $10 billion over the next decade by making some fixes to how the program is run overall and working on cutting waste, fraud, and abuse in various programs. This does mean that hundreds of thousands of households across the country will see less assistance, but won't necessarily have all of their assistance cut off. They're going after people who have been fraudulently collecting money from this program, perfectly capable adults who don't necessarily have dire economic need for the assistance. And by going after that and making some other adjustments, they'll likely get a deal and get that done. That's a big, significant piece of legislation.
And
there, the House might go on to things like immigration.
We have to say goodbye. We have to say goodbye, Ed O'Keefe. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Widener Law supports WHYY. Widener Law alumni are serving as judges, corporate lawyers, government officials, and more. In addition to engaging in challenging courses, Widener Law students work on real cases in law clinics. A JD information session will be held on January 11th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Delaware campus. Again, that's January 11th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Registration is available online at law.widener.edu/admissions. Widener Leadership Works.
The Paul Winter Consort presents a holiday gathering of friends, old and new, including a set by Paul Winter's early jazz sextet, reunited after 50 years. As always, the winter solstice celebration happens in New York's Cathedral of St. John the Divine, and we hope you'll join us for our annual holiday broadcast from NPR.
Saturday night at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, cooking for crowds isn't always easy, especially when you screw something up, just like author Mary White did with her Ukrainian soup.
But the usual thing I did besides crying was call up the cook down the block, who happened to be Julia Child.
That's lucky.
Man, was it ever.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just said goodbye to Ed O'Keefe, a congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. We were talking about the budget deal worked out in the U.S. Congress. Yesterday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke announced that the bank would cut its monthly bond purchases from $85 billion to $75 billion. That program was instituted to help the economy recover from the recession brought on by the financial crisis. Bernanke is finishing up his term at the Fed, and it looks like Janet Yellen will be confirmed as the new chair. We asked Jesse Eisenberg to join us to talk about this, the Volcker rule that was just passed in the state of financial reform. He's senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times deal book section and won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for his reporting on Wall Street's risky practices that led to the financial crisis, and joins us from the NPR studio in New York. And Jesse Eisenberg, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And someone said I said Jesse Eisenberg, and I apologize. It's Jesse Eisinger. So nice to have you back with us.
As long as you have me on the show, I don't really
Well, it's important to get people's names right. Let me begin with the announcement yesterday to cut this bond buying program by $10 billion starting in January. How significant is that, Jesse? And it seemed like it was anticipated, but nonetheless, it happened.
Right. It's an extremely modest change. What the market was worried about was a more dramatic pulling back of this bond buying, which is technically called quantitative easing.
Right,
that's the jargon. And so what they did was they pulled back from $85 billion a month to $75 billion a month, largely symbolic. In some ways, the entire program is symbolic to try to adjust expectations among investors that the Fed is not going to pull the rug out from under them until the economy is really going. And so that's why you saw investors in the announcement and bid stocks up, and stocks rose yesterday, and global markets did in general.
Right, and which was interesting because a couple of months ago when there was some kind of hint that they might do this, the stock market went in the other direction. Yesterday, everyone seemed pretty happy about it.
Right. So the market has become extremely accustomed to this kind of Federal Reserve support, and the mere hint that they might start at some point suggesting that they would pull back dramatically moved the bond market, and long-term interest rates rose pretty substantially and have not come back to the lows again. And the Fed was really concerned about that. But they were concerned for two reasons. One, they were concerned because it was sort of erasing the effect that their policies had. Right. The second concern is that investors are hanging on their every word so dramatically that anything they say now creates more volatility in the markets, and that's not really what they want. What they want is to have some steady expectations that investors take to heart, and then gradually they can pull back their support, the Fed can pull back their support, and the economy will become self-sustaining. But they've got themselves into a little bit of a box because investors are not calm, sensible creatures who sit around and have calm expectations about the global economy and the progress of humanity. They panic at every turn.
A highly reactive group of people. But yes. Would you say, Jesse, that QE worked? I think something like $1 trillion worth of bond buying. And worked by meaning, did it help the economy, the financial markets recover? Did it address the problem of unemployment at all? Is there any way
right.
to know that?
It's just been $1 trillion this year.
This year.
Many trillion dollars, more than $3 trillion in total. And there have been three rounds of QE. I think that in general, the clear answer to whether QE worked or not is no one knows. So there are a couple of things. The Federal Reserve had several extraordinary lending policies, and the government, of course, invested money in the banks in 2007, 2008, and continuing into 2009. And that clearly staved off the worst of the financial crisis. So you can credit them with that, and I do. The question then is whether the Fed's policies have helped the economy. The extraordinary policies have helped the economy in the years since, and the record is extremely mixed and difficult to ascertain. What essentially the Fed is undergoing is a kind of trickle-down policy, where they're hoping that monetary policy helps companies and the wealthy, and it kind of trickles down slowly into the economy and eventually will bring down unemployment and help prosperity in general. And the record is really mixed. The unemployment rate has come down slightly, but wages have not risen very much at all. And the working age population, the ratio of working age population that is employed has more or less not moved since the recession. And the general prosperity in the country is very poor. Median wages are still below where they were in 2000. So that's kind of, in fact, disastrous, I think. What is not disastrous is that corporate profits are at a record. The stock market is skyrocketing. Bond markets are skyrocketing. Initial public offerings are flourishing. The wealthy and investor class and banker class have done extraordinarily well by QE. The economy, not so much.
But does that help then explain this sort of disconnect between the financial part of the economy, and you say this is a larger piece of the economy than it used to be, and everybody else?
I think so. I think that we have not grappled with a few key aspects of the degree to which our economy has become financialized. As you say, the financial sector of the economy takes up roughly twice as much share of the economy, about 8% of the economy, as what it has done historically, which is about 4%. And so what are we getting for that money? What we would like to be getting is a much more efficient economy, because the financial sector should be a sector that sits between allocates capital efficiently, sits between people who have capital, savers, investors, and companies that have products and services that they want to sell to consumers or people who need a safe place to save. And they should do that very efficiently. But as the sector of the economy has grown, as finance has grown, it has actually become more expensive. Finance costs more. So even though trading of stocks seems to have fallen in our lifetimes, despite that, the amount that they're extracting as their VIG has gone up. And the prices that we see in the marketplace, stock prices, are communicating things to us, but they're not communicating things that are any better than what they were doing 50 years ago. So we're not getting any value for that. So I think the financial system is extremely broken, and we have not grappled with that.
What's VIG, V-I-G?
VIG, yeah, well, that's the mafia term for, I mean, not to say that all bankers are mafioso.
But, no.
You know,
what does
that's
that mean,
the
though,
term
VIG?
For taking a little bit of cut from your Vegas bet on, you know, the Super Bowl.
Oh, I see. Okay. Let me read you. I'm learning all sorts of things in this hour of Radio Times. And that's Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter at ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section, and we call him up from time to time on Radio Times to get us up to speed on some of the news related to the country's economy, the country's financial markets, Wall Street as well. Much news to talk about. Also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Jesse, just kind of segueing off of what you just said, the Volcker Rule was passed. Do you think it addresses some of the things that we're talking about, this idea of, I guess, separating investment from commercial banks?
Yeah, it may. The Volcker Rule was probably the one of the most important components of the Dodd-Frank law that passed 3.5 years ago, the overhaul of the financial regulatory architecture of the country. And what the Volcker Rule did is named after the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, and it's essentially a kind of backdoor Glass-Steagall Act. Glass-Steagall was a famous Depression-era law that separated commercial banking from investment banking. And this doesn't do that as dramatically, but what it does is it says that banks that are commercial banks that take deposits or have access to the Federal Reserve window, which is shorthand, that's basically backed by the government, subsidized by the government. Those kind of banks can't speculate with that money. Essentially, what that means is they can't make big bets where if they win, they get to keep the profits. But if they lose, they fall back on the federal government to make good on that. In other words, they keep the profits, but taxpayers take the losses. Right. So they want to minimize – the government wanted to minimize that in passing the Volcker Rule. And then it's been 3.5 years of intense lobbying from the banks, negotiations between five regulators to get the rules right, and we've got 71 pages of rules and literally hundreds and hundreds, almost 900 pages of commentary about those 71 pages of rules, and with various exemptions and exceptions, and we're going to try to prevent this kind of speculation while also allowing banks to conduct sort of normal activities, and we hope that it will be enforced precisely and perfectly so that the system becomes safer. I think it's going to be a difficult task.
We're getting some very strange feedback here.
From my comments? No.
I'm hearing me back in my headphones. I think, okay, we fix it. Sorry.
Okay,
great. I'm sorry, Jesse. But how will we know if the Volcker Rule is working?
Yeah, I think that's one of the key questions. At this point, we won't really know. The enforcement mechanisms are very weak. They're not criminal enforcement mechanisms. They're more sort of bank regulatory mechanisms where the bank regulators will go in and say, well, you shouldn't have done this, change your practices. If you don't do that, we'll fine you maybe modestly. Generally, those kind of things happen under the cover of darkness, and the public never knows. So there may be some disclosure about how much profit banks are making from trading and some and now they, of course, disclose some of that, but they disclose it extraordinarily opaquely. So the question would be, are they going to improve the disclosure of that? So one of the key questions in my mind is whether the public will have any ability to understand whether the Volcker Rule is actually working and being enforced. And I'm skeptical.
Well, and if there's 71 pages of rules and 900 pages of commentary, that tells us this is a very cumbersome piece of rulemaking.
Yes, I think it is a cumbersome piece of rulemaking. Now, so they have certain exemptions of standard banking practices that they're allowed to continue to do that can kind of look like this kind of speculative trading called proprietary trading. And the question is when they're engaged in those standard practices and when they're engaged in proprietary trading. One is called market making, which is where you stand between a buyer and a seller and you make a little money on that transaction, which is not a very risky activity. And we want banks to do that. And the question would be, sometimes what they do is they shade a little bit. They anticipate that a customer is going to want to buy IBM stock. And so they buy a bunch of IBM stock. Then the customer comes in and buys it and moves the stock price up, and the bank has made a lot of money on that. And we don't want them to do that. So the question will be, are you speculating or were you just market making? The other kind of exemption is hedging. Are you protecting yourself from bad outcomes? And we want banks to be prudent. We want them to hedge. We want them to be careful in their lending and their trading. And you can hedge by buying insurance contracts. In contracts called derivatives, you can hedge by buying a certain kind of stock like Coke and selling a certain kind of similar stock like Pepsi. You can do that in a variety of ways. But, of course, you can also make bets with that. You could bet that Coke is going to outperform Pepsi and have a view on that. We don't want them to do that. So to some extent, we're going to have to enter their minds and read them and find out if their hearts and minds are pure. Regulators tend to be pretty bad at that.
Well, and I'm wondering, even as you're talking, whether we have learned any of the lessons of the most recent financial crisis, which is that there was all this risky behavior going on. There were people who were charged with providing oversight, obviously a need for transparency, and whether we have learned that lesson and instituted some of those safeguards.
Right. I think we learned a lot of lessons from the financial crisis. I don't know if we instituted the changes that will resolve them. And I'm deeply worried about that. I think what we have done is some regulators use the metaphor that the banks were driving at 120 miles an hour down the highway, and we've got them down to 90 miles an hour, but that's still unsafe. And so we have increased the capital requirements of the banks so that the way they fund their businesses relies much more on shareholders, and the shareholders will take the first hits rather than the government. That's a good thing, but the question is whether they're capitalized adequately, whether they have enough cushion to absorb losses, and I don't think they do yet. Mm. And then the question will be, are the regulators enforcing the rules adequately? And are the derivatives markets going to be adequately regulated? These are all huge questions. And in the middle of this, we are seeing the markets soar because, in part, largely because of the Fed policy that we were talking about earlier, which has people worried that we're in a kind of nascent bubble period. I wouldn't say we have a bubble yet, but I think that we have markets that are too expensive. And when markets are too expensive, one thing that there's a risk is that they all turn bad at once.
Yikes.
Cause a lot of losses. So we are in an extraordinarily precarious position where we have implemented the lessons that we did learn from the financial crisis. And so I think we're in, we're on the cliff's edge.
About a minute before our break here, Jesse, but the too big to fail problem, has that been fixed to some degree?
I don't think so. The Treasury Secretary will disagree with me. He says they fixed it. The government says they fixed it. I simply don't believe it. It's an extraordinarily complex problem. But what they say is, yes, now the government, when they are confronted with a giant failing financial institution like if J.P. Morgan, God forbid, was on the brink of failure, the government could either put that entity into bankruptcy or they could resolve it by doing some bridge lending and selling off the parts to it, of it, and that would mitigate the crisis. It would and it would also shield taxpayers from having to absorb any of the losses. And my view is that is extraordinarily sunny thinking that is probably not accurate.
And that's Jesse Eisinger, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, senior reporter at ProPublica. He covers Wall Street and finance. That's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. We're also taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, give us a call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
April 15th may be months away, but now is the time to get your last-minute tax deduction. Support WHYY now to help us end the year on a high note. Whether you give a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
I'm going to do what God put Ron Burgundy on this earth to do. Have salon-quality hair and read the news.
Ron Burgundy is back in the anchor chair in Anchorman 2. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's star, Will Ferrell, and the director, Adam McKay, who co-wrote the film with Ferrell. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Yeah. Seeking the Middle.
These areas around the cities are doing quite well economically. And then as you get further out into more rural places, you watch the incomes drop off.
The median income in America says a lot about our country. The middle is not the average. Who sits in the middle and why? Reports from the middle. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with ProPublica's Jesse Eisinger. He's catching us up on a busy few days of financial news, including changes at the Federal Reserve, the passage of the Volcker Rule, and the state of financial reform. He's got a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for his reporting on Wall Street's risky practices that led to the financial crisis that we're still digging out of. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9444. It looks like Janet Yellen will be confirmed as the new head of the Federal Reserve. Do you anticipate any changes under her leadership?
Not in the immediate term. Bernanke yesterday said that Yellen is fully in agreement with the policy that they announced, which is the modest tapering that we talked about. But then what they're saying is, as long as inflation is low, below our target, and as long as the unemployment rate at 7% is above where we want it to be, we're going to be extraordinarily accommodative for a long time. What they want to do is say, we really, really are going to wait until we see any signs of danger, any signs of inflation or overheating before we dramatically pull back. Mm. That is Yellen's view. She's viewed as very dovish, which means that she's not worried about inflation, which I believe is the correct thing to not – it's not a worry right now. And there's the expectation is that she will continue these policies.
We got an email from John. Is there a better economic indicator than the stock market averages, NASDAQ, Dow, et cetera? How do you, I guess, determine the state of the economy?
Oh, yeah. Well, I largely ignore the stock market. I think the stock market is a terrible economic indicator. Especially the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is only 30 companies. They're not particularly representative. It's kind of historical artifact that we follow it. The S&P 500 with 500 companies is a little bit better, but there are a lot of companies that aren't included. There are a lot of private companies, small businesses. I think what you want to look at, GDP, obviously, is a good indicator. You want to look at final demand, which is how much consumers are actually buying. And then I like to look at unemployment, the employment population ratio. You can look at median income. What I want to see is broadly shared prosperity by across the economy. It doesn't seem to me to be satisfying or the right thing for companies to have extraordinary margins but not paying their workers adequate salaries. That seems to me to be a failure of the economy. What I look at.
And that's what you look at. Let me ask you a little bit about Jamie Dimon. He worked out a settlement with the Justice Department for JP Morgan Chase, a settlement of something like $13 billion. But I noticed, and this is from some of your reporting and some other reporting I've read, is it seems that the Justice Department is instituting fines but allowing people to avoid prosecution. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so the Justice Department has gotten marginally more aggressive in the last couple of years, or really last few months. So they fined J.P. Morgan what seems like a huge amount, $13 billion. Yeah. In fact, that's not really the amount that they're fining. J.P. Morgan's in fact settling some private contractual disputes with that. And some of that is punitive. Some of that is merely giving money to homeowners that have been abused by J.P. Morgan. So the headline number overstates it. But the central issue here is that even when they're charging criminally or getting guilty pleas from financial institutions, and JP Morgan is the prime example here, the Justice Department is not able or willing to go after individuals. So you have them settling with corporations. Even so, what they say is, look, we're settling, but we're getting guilty pleas. We're getting them to admit wrongdoing. We're actually getting – we're charging them criminally rather than civilly. That's a step of toward being a much more aggressive toward these institutions. And – but you see that no one, when a bank is accused of a crime, no one seems to have committed the crime. No human being has committed a crime. And I know that, you know, Mitt Romney said that corporations are people, but it seems to me corporations are made up of people. And if there's a crime committed, somebody had to commit it.
Well, Jesse, let me just quote you something you wrote back in October. You said, I hate to be the bearer of good news for Jamie Dimon, but everything is going to work out okay. How do I know? Two words, Lloyd Blankenfein.
Yes. So my view is that the consequences to these guys have been few, if any. And you look around. So we talked earlier about the lessons from the financial crisis, and the regulators and the population have learned lessons. And I think the bankers have learned a different lesson. The bankers learned the lesson that they said, well, my colleagues, in some cases, I helped blow up the global economy and caused billions and trillions of dollars of losses. And in some cases, we were kind of misleading about the state of our businesses. And what happened? Well, nothing. No, none of my colleagues went to prison. None of my colleagues was particularly fined. And the social consequences of this were almost nil. These guys still get to go to galas at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They still are asked to be on think tanks and to chair charity boards. The social consequence, they have not become pariahs. Lloyd Blankfein goes on with his life despite having gotten the largest fine in the history of the Securities and Exchange Commission for his bank, presiding over the what I think is the reputational collapse of Goldman Sachs. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, has had no consequences. Most significantly, he got to keep his job. The board didn't think that he was worthy of being pushed aside. And so I think everything's going to work out fine for Jamie Dimon, socially, economically. I think that's a big problem with our society.
Well, it reminds me of that famous question from the 50s, you know, have you no shame, sir?
Right. I agree. And I think that shame is dead on Wall Street and that these guys haven't faced any consequences. And in fact, they feel the reverse of shame. They feel a righteous indignation that people wouldn't see that they're doing great things for the economy and for society. They think that they have been victims, that they have been assailed, that unfairly, that they are representatives of some evil wealthy financiers in some kind of stereotypical way, and that the public just doesn't understand all the good they do. They have the exact opposite view.
And that's, again, Jesse Eisinger writes for ProPublica, writes about the financial sector. And we've been talking about the Federal Reserve, the passage of the Volcker Rule, the state of financial reform. And he also writes for the New York Times and got a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for his reporting on Wall Street's risky practices that led to the most recent financial crisis. I think we're having some phone problems here. I'll give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. We had Jack, looks like, has a question. If a bank is too big to fail, doesn't that make a good investment for the average person to buy their stock? sort of a convoluted, interesting question there, but what do you think, Jesse?
Well, not necessarily, of course, because the stock could go nowhere. But I think that the large banks in this country are too big to fail, and that it presents a problem for the economy. And the reason why they wouldn't necessarily be good stocks is that they're probably inefficient, lumbering beasts that aren't encouraged to break up and become much more efficient because they like to be big to maintain their subsidies and implicit guarantees and backing from the federal government. I think that the investors like that aspect of it too. So there's been some talk that, oh, maybe investors will break up these banks because they're trading so inefficiently, their valuations are so low, and the investors will wake up to these inefficiencies and demand that Jamie Dimon sell off the pieces of the business to get value. And I think that's the exact opposite of reality, and that investors, in fact, like these subsidies, like this protection, like these insurance contracts that are implicitly offered by the government. And so, you know, even though the stocks are not performing very well, although they've performed very well in the last year, they're protected here.
I always think of, I don't always, but I sometimes think of December as the kind of bonus season for some sectors of the economy. I think the financial sector, known for some pretty generous bonuses over the years. Is that going to be true this year too, Jesse, do you think?
Yeah, that comes actually in a few months into the new year on Wall Street, February typically. And bonuses have been very good recently. They, you know, weren't quite as good in the last year as they were in 2009-2010, but bonuses are good. Wall Street is booming. IPOs are booming. Business is great. Trading is way up. The stock market, as we discussed, is up. That makes people very happy. Business is very good on Wall Street. Wall Street is back. And if that were good for America, it would be great, but it's not.
How much of Dodd-Frank has actually been written over the last couple of years?
Dodd-Frank's, the rules around Dodd-Frank is roughly about 40%. So it's going extraordinarily slowly. These are very complicated rules, but what's happened is that the banks took a few tactics here. First, of course, they lobbied against Dodd-Frank, and they were some modestly successful on certain aspects of it. Then what they did is they've lobbied their friends in Congress, particularly Republicans in the House, to have them repeal aspects of Dodd-Frank. That hasn't been successful, but it has led to sort of delays and concerns. Then the banks have attacked these laws legally through the courts, saying that they're unconstitutional or violate various rules and laws. And then the fourth tactic is that they have lobbied under the relative cover of darkness, the regulators. We don't really see that much against rules like the Volcker Rule, and also to push exemptions. And that has been quite successful and led to delaying tactics. So they had this sort of forefront strategy to attack Dodd-Frank, and some have been more successful than others, but the war generally is going, I think, in the bank's favor.
And is that just because of the power that they have in Washington?
Yeah, so they have the banks take up something like 90% of the meetings with regulators. The public doesn't have any effective ability to mobilize against bank regulations or groups that further these interests. You know, there are few good, smart public interest groups that look at financial regulation, but they are so outgunned and outmanned by the vast array of lawyers and accountants and consultants and banks themselves that lobby against the rules. The banks have and the banks fund, you know, the campaigns. I think the banks have largely captured the political class in Washington, with some exceptions.
Let me ask you about the mortgage market. And I think we're certainly seeing some house prices going up in parts of the country. It looks like some of those bankruptcies and failed mortgages, I think we're getting to the bottom of that. But what do you see as the future of Fannie and Freddie, as we call them?
Yeah, that's a fascinating issue. What's happening is, yes, the housing market is back largely in most many places, and that's a very good thing for average people. And what's happening is that the government is backing about 90% of the mortgages that are being made, mostly through Fannie and Freddie, which are these giant mortgage companies that failed and were taken over by the federal government and are now in this kind of quasi-stasis. And the question is, what do you do with these? And the consensus in Washington is that we want private capital to be back in the mortgage market. We'd rather have some private companies doing this with some role of the government. And the right says there should be no role, and the left, as it's constituted in Washington, says, well, the government should have some role. Now, there is this other opinion, but it essentially has no voice in Washington, which says, well, actually, I think that the government might, it might be a proper role for the government to guarantee most mortgages or plain vanilla mortgages. They probably do it very efficiently. But that's essentially a non-starter in Washington. So what's going to happen is we're going to have a big debate about what to do with Fannie and Freddie, and we're going to get toward a solution, but it's moving extraordinarily slowly. And you know, so that's not going to resolve itself in the next year or two.
And I asked you about VIG very briefly. Plain vanilla mortgages, these are sort of mortgages for people with jobs and things like a little bit of assets.
Well, yeah, 30-year mortgages that with a fixed rate, where the borrower has a decent credit rating and puts down something like 20%. Fannie and Freddie does – that's the bread and butter of Fannie and Freddie. They're called conforming mortgages, and they go up to a certain rate and they're not – a certain amount and they're not over that. Those are the standard kind of mortgage that most people in the country get. That's a very efficient product. It's a product that the private sector might have a lot of difficulty or reluctance to do to offer, especially at a cheap rate. And so the government might be able to do that much more efficiently.
Well, Jesse Eisinger, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back, Mike.
You're welcome. Senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. And we began our conversation with Ed O'Keefe, a congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you for joining us. And stay with us. We'll be right back.